So excited to have you, Sneha.
I'm really excited to be here.
You've been on my list of dream podcast guests since I started Brand Game Strong.
I mean, I've wanted to be on Brand Game Strong since you started it because I love your whole sort of the way you represent the South Asian space. I think it's phenomenal. So it's my honor.
It's so good to have you.
I'm really happy to be here.
How are you? How's your week been?
It's been quite nice. Mm. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time with my family. So yeah, can't complain. It's been a really nice week.
Yeah, did you have a good Easter?
Yes, it was lovely. Again, just spent a lot of time with my family, saw a few friends, just fed my soul. So, you know, really, really good.
It's what so about weird you? Seeing you after so many years.
I think the last time I saw you probably was at uni.
Probably in the library.
Yeah, it was a very long time ago. So yeah. this is really refreshing to be able to like connect with you. And I think it's also just been nice because in a weird way, like obviously social media has its like downsides to it. But the great thing is we've stayed in touch through social media, right? Like I've watched you through your different ventures. I've watched you sort of like, you know, just your life unfold. And it's I felt still connected to your journey, even though we haven't seen each other in years, like you said. So I think that's a huge plus from the social media end, I guess.
Yeah, I absolutely feel the same way. And I think I've said to you as well, I think I've always been like a big admirer of you and your work. Even before you were doing calligraphy, to be honest, even in uni, I would always look up to you. But also, I feel like when you did start embarking on your calligraphy journey, which we'll speak about in a second, I was so mind blown because your work was so, I guess, rebellious in a way. It felt different. It felt so unique. I don't think I knew anyone else doing the combination of things that you were doing and doing so well and so graciously, and also like had no idea you were so, so good at this as well. Yeah, so it's been amazing also watching your journey and just feeling really inspired by you. Like I remember very particularly in lockdown times, and I think I messaged you about it as well. I was very drawn towards art and I was drawn towards creativity, and I started pursuing my own creative like little ventures and stuff. But you were very much someone that I saw your stuff and it just made me feel happy. It kind of got me through lots of difficult times. And I don't think I'm the only one when I say that. So thank you for doing that for me during lockdown. And I don't think I'll forget that. So yeah. And it's hard because I guess when you are doing this work, like we said, do you even realize the reach that you have?
No. Yeah. To be honest, I think it's quite similar to what you said initially. When you put yourself out there, you're being quite vulnerable, especially when you're putting yourself out there on social media, right? You're basically putting yourself out there to the world in a public view. And I remember when I started my page, I started it in secret. I think I only maybe told my husband. I didn't tell anybody else. I didn't even put it on like my main like personal Instagram page because I was kind of like, what if people laugh at me? And I think that was I put it out in a massive state of vulnerability, but I knew, I don't know what drove me to do it, but I did it. And I think it was getting those little bits of feedback from people where they were like, oh, I actually really enjoyed that, that then spurred me on to create something more. And it kind of then snowballed. But now when people reach out to me and say things like, oh, you know, I'm inspired by your journey, or that you like, you know, inspired me to learn calligraphy, you inspired me to pursue my second hobby or anything like that, it makes me feel good because, as with everything, I have my down days, even with paint pots and quills. And I think it makes such a big difference hearing those stories or having those people reach out because it makes it meaningful.
Tell me about you. What do you do? Because we've kind of touched on it, but I want you to say it in your own words.
So I'm a doctor. I'm currently training to be a neurologist, and I am also a calligraphy artist.
Okay. And you're killing it in every area of life. And also just being a generally nice, lovely person, which I think is just like the cherry on top of anything, right? Whenever you see people who are talented, and it can be quite hard, I think, in the social media world to also know who, you know, what intentions people have and that kind of thing. And over time, I feel like intention comes through. And I think me having followed your calligraphy work and just known you over the years, you can tell that it comes from a genuine place and that you are just trying to put something out there that hopefully might help people, but it helps you.
Mm.
And I think when it comes from a place of like, it helps me, then it automatically will help others. But it's amazing that you have a full-time career in medicine at the same time. I want to ask you a lot about what drove you to go into medicine and how that journey has unfolded for you. But I want to take it back a step and ask you a little bit about when you were a baby. So tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what is your cultural heritage? What was your relationship like with your roots growing up?
So I'm Indian. I'm South Indian Tamil. I was born and brought up in Mumbai till the age of 11. So my family, whilst we were all South Indian Tamils, we lived, I think, for a couple of generations, we've lived in Mumbai. So I had I think anyone that understands the South Asian sort of culture knows that there are micro cultures even within, you know, pockets of India. So I grew up with that sort of Maharashtrian influence, you know, learning Hindi and Marathi, but also being very, very grounded with my roots in terms of like Tamil as well.
Hmm.
My parents and grandparents have always been very, like, a huge part of my life.
Hmm.
And now that you're prompting me to think back on my childhood, actually, my childhood was beautiful.
Hmm.
I, you know, got to really experience that sort of very true sort of Indian experience, in the sense, you know, my childhood was full of like Parle G and Maggie and, you know, all the things that we now look back with nostalgia. That was my childhood. So I couldn't be more grateful for it. And I wouldn't ever want to change that, because it was one of the best things in my life. When I look back at my childhood, that's my happy place.
Mm.
I was also quite close to my great grandparents, being the oldest grandchild in the family, like the first basically grandchild in the family. So I was also quite close to my great grandparents for a couple of years, and I heard their stories. And, you know, it's all a part of you. And I think that's a really valuable experience that I'm grateful that I got to have. So yeah, that was my childhood. And then I moved here with my parents at the age of 11. And that was a culture shock, a mm-hmm. massive culture shock for somebody who has grown up in India. And then to move at that age, when you're kind of just about sort of finding yourself from like sort of that kid stage to starting to maybe grow up and have a few more sort of, you know, adult experiences, in the sense of like friendships. And so I think that was a challenging time for me.
How specifically was it a culture shock for you?
So I came from India and I had a very strong Indian accent. Kids are mean. I mean, I think just out there, because I think at that age as well, they find their voices. And I think not everybody is okay to accept someone that looks or sounds a bit different.
Yeah.
So I think that was a big, big thing for me. So coming from India, where, you know, being clever meant that you were the most popular kid in class, to coming here, where actually being clever was not really that, like, it wasn't really considered cool. So I think that was a struggle, because I kind of just lost my sense of identity a little bit when I came here. And also obviously the fact that I sounded different meant that I wasn't as easily accepted. But I think in looking back at it, I think it kind of, I always say this, I think at any point when you're faced with change, especially a change where you have to change within yourself, you need to look at it. You can either change in a negative way or you can change in a positive way. And I think it brought me some great things. So that's how I met one of my long-term best friends, who is still my best friend since the age of 11. And, you know, I wouldn't have found her if it wasn't that I was in a state of adversity and I needed somebody to, you know, have my back, and she did. And that formed for me a lifelong friendship. So yeah, I think that's kind of my journey to coming here.
Do you look back at it fondly? Do you look back at it with nostalgia, sadness, grief?
I look back at it. So my one philosophy in life is to never look at anything with regret.
Mm.
Even my worst experiences have shaped me into the person I am today. And so I don't think I look at anything with anything but sort of like an element of gratitude to say, I'm grateful that happened to me, because actually if I didn't feel bullied, or if I didn't feel X, Y, and Z, I probably wouldn't have tried to adapt. And if I didn't adapt, then I wouldn't have had the ability to adapt and change that I do today.
Mm.
So I think all of those experiences are a key part of who I am. So I would never look at any of them with any negativity.
Mm. I like that answer. I've really changed the way that I look at my childhood, and I've been called out on it before. By my friends, where, you know, I've been told like, oh, you look at things with a lot of negativity. And I think it just comes from also growing up, right? I think in the last 2-3 years, I've looked back and focused more on, like you said, right, on the adaptability aspect of it, on the fact that like those adversities have now led to so much creativity, and it's just come out in like bursts. And I'm sure it's like been similar for you. I like that you've kind of framed it in a way that it's working for you. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, our story is our story. We can't change it.
No.
So we can only change the way we look at it and how we feel about it. So you said you were, you grew up in Mumbai. You were very in touch with your roots. Do you go back? Did you go back quite a bit growing up?
Yes. So I used to go back. I think we used to go back every year. Sort of summer holidays, where we'd go back, see my grandparents. Most of my family's in India, so would go back for that reason, and it would always be like my favorite time of year. I haven't been back as much as I would like since the pandemic, and hopefully I'd be able to change that. But I did go back literally before the pandemic hit, so that was the last time I went back, and part of my heart will always be in India.
What's it like being a South Indian who grew up in Mumbai?
I think I see it as the best of both worlds.
Mm.
Because I'm obsessed with like street food.
Me
and
too.
Chat. Like, I can literally, like, yeah, I can eat it every single day for the rest of my life if you tell me that's what I have to do. But I also love South Indian food, like dosas and idlis. And so, you know, when I'd go out with my friends, I'd be able to like go and have street food and like the authentic street food, like the place where it all came from. And then to be able to come home and still have like, you know, I see it as the best of both worlds. I have friends from many different sort of, you know, subsects of India in essence. And I think it's all kind of enriched my childhood and continues to enrich my adulthood. Mm. So I think it's best of both.
Oh, you're making me salivate now. you also mentioned you were close to your great grandparents and you had a lot of elders in your life that you looked up to. What sort of lessons and key things have you picked up from them that you implement in your life?
I think it's so my grandmother, and I speak about this a lot on my Instagram page. So my dad's mum is one of my biggest sort of inspiration when it comes to creativity. It was actually from her that she was the one that taught me sort of arts when I was younger. So I'd go to her house and like summer vacations, and she would have a different art form every time. So it'd be like glass painting, flower making, like soap carving, like, you know, you name it, she's done it. And she found so much joy in creating that she instilled that within me from quite a young age.
Mm.
And I still remember when sort of she was going through a difficult time when my grandfather passed away. And again, she turned to her art. Mm. She started making things for other people. And I still see her doing that, you know, even today when, you know, her eyes aren't as sharp as they used to be or her hands tremble, she will still make things and gift it to people because she gets so much joy from just creating and being in that moment. And the joy that it brings other people when they see her art. And I think that is a huge part of the ethos behind sort of my brand. And I've always sort of strived to make it quite a positive, welcoming space where everybody can find their escape. And I think a big part of that is from her. Because I see her, you know, she's kind of like leave, you know, no art unconquered kind of attitude. And she's always taught me, if you don't try, you'll never know.
Mm.
So, you know, it doesn't matter if you fail. It doesn't matter if you try something and you're bad at it. What's important is that you tried, because had I not tried, if I didn't walk into that craft shop to say, let me just try calligraphy, I don't think I'd be where I am today in terms of everything that I have in my life. So I think it's a really big, that's one of the really big lessons I've learned. And I think also just from my grandparents and my great grandparents, I've just learned this. I mean, they're just a different generation. They're just a different era. Like the way they used to do things is so pure that I think it's wonderful to still be able to bring that into our everyday lives. But I think it's just sort of the devotion. I'm struggling to find the right word, but I think it's the sheer devotion that they had for their family. You know, that they would just, like, their family was their everything. Mm. You know, everything they did is some way or another interconnected with something for their family. And I think that is something that I'm grateful to have learned from them and hope to continue sort of bringing into my life.
That's so beautiful that there's such a clear story behind all the things that, I guess, pique your interest nowadays. And it was, while you were speaking, it got me reflecting on my relationship with my grandma as well, my dad's mom. And she was an entrepreneur. And she had a period of time where, you know, she was pretty much like running the show in our family business. And this is what I hear. And it kind of makes me wonder, like, is that where that fire came from, you know, that I've got in mm-hmm, me to mm-hmm. maybe prove myself or make a difference or do something that will be worthwhile? And it's interesting that you mentioned that it was your grandma that encouraged you to take risks, because a big part of the immigrant experience is about being risk averse. Like for me, it has very much always been like, you know, go for the most stable career choice. Do not color outside the lines too much, because you'll ruffle too many feathers. And we anyways don't have as many opportunities as it is. So we need to work with what we've got. There was a lot of like, work with what you've got, be grateful for what you've got and just run with it. Don't complain. And I think it wasn't explicitly said, but I think it was the value system with which I was brought up in my little immigrant household. Yet I think going back home, visiting grandparents, it's such a different narrative. And I don't know, it was just really interesting hearing that contrast between the generations and the kind of influence that the different generations have had on us. Mm-hmm. And I really wonder whether there was a combination of that, which is what led you to pursue medicine as well as pursuing calligraphy, mm-hmm. Hand in hand. So maybe we can take it now to what actually drove you into going into medicine. What was that point where you decided that is the career that you wanted to choose for yourself?
So I think the answer to this is kind of a little bit boring, in the sense that I think I was always inclined towards sciences. Mm. I always enjoyed biology. I always enjoyed chemistry. I think it was something that felt like a natural fit to me. I think my parents were pretty supportive in the sense, like, I don't think maybe because I was naturally inclined that way, we never really had that conversation that you have to be a doctor or an engineer. But to be honest, I don't think they would have been unsupportive even if I chose something outside of that standard bracket of things, as you mentioned, that, you know, Asian households tend to push us towards. But I was always inclined that way. I've always wanted to do medicine.
Mm.
And my journey into medicine wasn't completely straightforward. I had to take a year out to get into medicine. And I think in that year, I realized even more, this is absolutely, I can't see myself doing anything else. I couldn't even imagine applying to something else to consider it, because this is where I always knew I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most fulfilling careers, especially if you're inclined that way. I think it's wonderful.
Mm.
And the way I see it is that you have one life. You mm. have this one, you know, even if you believe in sort of, you know, life after death and things like that, but this is one reality you get to live in, this exact sort of, you know, combination of things. And I think you've just got to be the best version of yourself. And like you said, do whatever you can to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And for me, because I knew I always liked science, I always liked biology, I was interested in medicine, I felt it felt like a natural fit for me to go into that, to then make a difference, in essence.
Mm. You mentioned that it was a bit of a tumultuous journey. What happened in that year?
So I think it was basically that one of my exams was marked wrongly. So I had to take a year out to reapply. In a way, it worked out better for me because I ended up going to a completely different university, one that I initially didn't think I was good enough to go to, in essence. So yeah, that worked out somehow better than my initial choice. I worked the hardest I've ever worked. And I think I surpassed everyone's expectations that year. I surpassed my own expectations because I gave it so much that, you know, I went into it and there was no way they could turn me down. Like, you know, I was like, I'm going to go back and I'm going to show them grades. I'm going to show them marks that they've never seen before. And I'm going to really kind of make a difference here. So that's how my journey into medicine came about. And I think I always believe this. I think these things happen for the best. I think that was how my journey was supposed to be. I think it reinforced within me that this is what I wanted to do. And I use that as a story, like let's for other people that are applying or have been deterred to apply or for whatever reason it hasn't worked out. I've always told them, you know, this isn't the end of the road. There are many more avenues, and just because you've not gone down the standard path doesn't mean there's not other paths that lead to that same destination. And you know, I think I remember when I came into uni, I still felt inadequate because I was like aware that I obviously had to take a year out to come into it. And you know, I think that feeling never fully went away until I graduated, and I graduated with a distinction in medicine and surgery, because I was like, I'm not going to leave this process without making myself feel like I'm worthy of this. So I think, I think my life's always been that way. I always joke about it with my mum, but I think I flourish in the face of adversity. Like, I think if I'm challenged with something, I tend to try and rise higher because, well, what else can you do? You can be beaten by it or you can beat it, so...
I have a lot of parallels in my story, I guess, compared to like what you've just mentioned as well. And I was just thinking about it all. And actually very recently I've started joining the dots back. And you know how they say like when you join the dots, it all starts to make sense. And I know it sounds so cliche, but genuinely the years that I've found the hardest, and I've had setbacks too in my, you know, education as well as in my career. Well, perceived setbacks, because society likes to remind us that if we're not, you know, shooting ahead for every next promotion and every like distinction and like top grades, then we are failing, which is absolutely not true. But those have been the years that have actually shaped me in many ways to become the person that I am, the curious person that I am, maybe forced me to pursue other avenues just to feel like adequate, like you said. And I think that just, it's like this messy, beautiful, like mixture, isn't it? Of the person that we become, from the successes as well as the setbacks. And it's, I don't know, I wouldn't have it any other way.
No, I couldn't agree more.
And we went to the same uni, so.
Yes.
We also wouldn't have met, but yeah, I completely feel you. I think everybody who went to that university particularly probably has similar stories. Yeah, that's really interesting that you said also that medicine was something that you were naturally drawn to. It's quite different to what you hear often about people who almost get like coaxed into medicine, or you know, they're brought up thinking that's the only career choice. It's really amazing to hear that it was a very conscious decision for you and that you had the ability to make that choice for yourself. And that you've stuck it out this many years. Have you ever had moments where you've questioned your choice or wanted to change your path?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like with every job, I have my bad days. Like, you know, it's natural. But I don't think I've ever questioned it. I think it's sort of like a part of me. I find so much joy, so much gratification, so much sort of, like I take away so much from my day job, from experiences, from interactions with my patients, that I don't think anything is more fulfilling than being able to come home and feel like I've made a difference to somebody.
Mm.
Somebody's life, somebody's future, somebody's, you know, like, because every, like, I think it is a huge, huge place of privilege to be a doctor, because people tell you their deepest secrets. People tell me secrets that they don't tell their spouses. And they trust you so much, a complete stranger, and they trust you so much with these secrets. And they trust that you will, with them, make the right decision for them. And I think that is a huge place of privilege. And I think it's an honor to be in that position. And so I don't think I'll ever sort of take that lightly. Obviously, there have been days where I felt burnt out, but I think that's more the system than the job.
Hmm.
And yeah, I've considered sort of ways of, you know, moving forward and like adapting my lifestyle outside of work, or my coping strategies outside of work, to be able to better support myself. But I don't think till now I've had a day where I've regretted or felt any differently about my job.
What's been the hardest moment in your career as a doctor?
I think the pandemic, and I think most people would say that, was very hard, in the sense that we were obviously giving our 110%. Mm. You know, we were working crazy hours because of the clinical demand, and we were really sort of like pushing ourselves physically, emotionally, and people were still dying, you know, like, because it was just, it hit us in such sort of magnitude in that moment that there was nothing we could do to, like, and I think that was hard, because it felt like you were pushing yourself beyond where you knew your limit lay, because you wanted to like just do everything you could to help everyone, and you'd still have to deal with, you know, situations that weren't going the way you'd want them to. And I think emotionally that was hard. And I think I remember coming home and I would cry about some of my patients, because it would break my heart that, you know, you come back and you think, why that person? Like, you know, I wish there was anything that could have been done, we could have saved them. But like, there's nothing, it's just the reality of the job we do. And yeah, and I think in the pandemic in particular, because it was so concentrated, like the general doctor experience was so concentrated, and you didn't have anything outside of, you know, that was kind of it, right? Like, we were going to work,
yeah,
coming home, and we weren't socializing with anybody. We couldn't see our family. We couldn't see our friends. So you kind of became isolated. Those experiences were everything. And I think in a way it made us so close with our colleagues. So the doctors I worked with around the pandemic have become some of my closest friends. They came to our wedding, like, you know, because we lived through those experiences together. You know, we cheered our wins when we were able to, you know, get a patient better and discharge them from hospital. And we grieved together.
Mm.
And I think that was easily the hardest part of being of my career, to be honest.
Mm. And it's experiences like these where you find true connection with people who are in it with you, right?
Yeah.
It's like an experience that nobody else can understand, that you will, it's like unspoken.
Yeah.
You just know.
I have so much love for the doctors, the nurses, the, you know, the ward staff, the porters, like everybody, because we were all, I think there was this huge sense of camaraderie where we were like, we're doing this together. Like, you know, it was kind of like us versus the enemy, which was obviously the virus. And there was that sense of camaraderie that I think sort of almost carried us through that time. But yeah, that was easily the hardest.
Do you think that period of time, having to work as a doctor and, you know, being the superhero that you were, has that changed you as a doctor now?
I think it made me realize that I needed my calligraphy. I think that was the big revelation. I think up until that point, I was doing it. It was kind of like a side hustle, like a bit of a hobby. Like, it wasn't really, I didn't really realize how much I needed it in my life until the pandemic. And I obviously started recording videos and teaching people calligraphy in my spare time while still working full time during the pandemic, because I wanted to find a way to help people stay at home. I wanted to help people find a mindful moment within their home. I wanted them to focus on something else rather than everything else that was happening in the world at the time. And I think that drove me to continue doing that outside. And I realized, actually, my calligraphy is like exercise for my mind. It is my meditation. It is what I need outside of work. Like, it's as much as I need to like drink water to stay hydrated, I need to do this because this is what allows my mind to escape. And I could feel, I think, because the first couple of weeks I didn't even think about my calligraphy. Like, I was just, we were obviously hit so hard. We were just like, we just need to all hands on deck, get through this, try and figure out what to do. And those first few weeks were really hard until I rediscovered wanting to do it. And I think that's what the pandemic really changed within me, is that I now know that this is not just something I'm doing for the sake of content. This is not something I'm doing for the sake of money. Like, I'm not doing it for any of that. I'm doing it because I need this. And yeah, I think that's what changed for me.
That segues nicely into our next section, which is, how did you get into calligraphy?
So I started learning. I was always kind of inclined towards it. I was always like intrigued by it, but I never really had the motivation to do it until a friend of mine was getting married, and it was in my year out where I was traveling, and she said, oh, you know, will you help me with my wedding invitations? And I thought, okay, well, this is a time as any for me to potentially try that calligraphy thing that I've always wanted to potentially, like, you know, learn. And I just went into a craft store, bought a kit, and started learning off like YouTube tutorials and like copying other people on Instagram. Like, you know, when I would just watch the way someone wrote their A and like write it myself in like my little journal. And then over time, I just kept doing that. I created my own little alphabet almost of like, you know, different ways to write different alphabet. And I started doing it more and more to unwind. And that was obviously during my year out. And then I kind of did it for my friend's wedding, and that was kind of really it. And then I started a new job. So I just moved. So I'd moved from Southampton to, you know, just North London-ish. And I started a new job and everything was new. It was a change, like, and, you know, new people, new role. And I started feeling that stress again. I was really kind of like struggling to find something that could help me focus, that could help me sleep at night. Like, I was, you know, starting to have a little bit of built up anxiety with all this change. And so I tapped back into my calligraphy at that point, and I started just, you know, I'd try and make it sort of build it into my nighttime routine. So I would switch off my mobile phone, I would just, you know, dim the light, and I would just aimlessly write words or alphabets. And I would do that until I would start to feel sleepy. And then I realized that I was sleeping better. Mm. I wasn't having nightmares. Like, I wasn't waking up in the morning with like some sort of dread, because I think your subconscious is the most vulnerable as you're falling asleep. And I think that's why it's really important to, you know, have positive things in your mind when you're going to sleep, because that is what your subconscious rides with through the night. And then that's what you wake up with in the morning. So I think it's a really important part of sleep hygiene. And I think I built it into my life in that way. And then kind of thought, oh, you know, like, maybe I'll just start a separate Instagram page just to kind of put my work out there. Mm. And started doing that. And then I still remember the very first time someone contacted me to say, would you do a commission for my wedding envelopes? And I was like, oh my God, somebody wants me to do their wedding envelopes. Like, they actually look at my work and they want me to do that. And I think I remember it was like the biggest win at the time, because I was like, somebody actually wants me to like do this. This is, they're trusting me with this. And yeah, that's how it all began.
You then went on to work on some really cool projects, and I'm just going to name it because I know you probably won't, but I have seen you work for massive brands that I really love and use myself, like Glossier, Diptyque. You've worked for Dior, you work for Armani, and you've also been the official calligrapher at Cannes Film Festival. what the hell? How did you imagine that you would work with these brands ever? How did it happen? When did the first one kind of come about? And did you pursue it? Did it pursue you? Tell me everything.
It was a combination. I think I did an event for Oliver Bonus a while ago, and I just kind of connected with someone that worked there. Happened to mention, by the way, I do some calligraphy. And they were kind of like, yeah, we're having this launch for this spring season collection. Why don't you come along? And again, I was kind of like, it happened organically kind of. And I went for their spring summer launch and I met loads of their influencers. And it was an event that really connected with me and my brand as well, because I was writing affirmations and I was writing positive quotes for them to hang up on their walls. And I'm still really good friends with a lot of people I met that day. And I realized when I did that I was like, I love this. Like, I'm a people person. Even obviously I deal with patients in my day job, and I love interacting with people. I love meeting new people. I think it enriches your life in like many ways. There's so much to learn from everyone that you meet. And for that reason, I absolutely loved this event. And then it kind of was a bit of a slow kind of, nothing really was happening. I was, you know, exploring avenues. I was creating things, putting them out there. But again, I wasn't really expecting anything out of it. And I think the good thing about doing this as sort of like a secondary thing at the time was that I was never looking at anything and feeling failure. So if a post didn't do well, I wouldn't feel like it was failing. I would just look at it and think, oh, it's got 4 likes. That's 4 more than I was expecting it to get. So I would look at it, I would look at the success. And I think that mind frame, and I do think having a positive mindset is a big factor in your life in general. And I think I never looked at it with any negativity, and I think that really helped. Cans happened in the weirdest way, because I got an email from someone who'd seen my post. I think they'd seen a hashtag on my post. And I got this email to say, we're looking for a calligrapher at the Cannes Film Festival. It was like really last minute. I think potentially their calligrapher had dropped out at the time. And it was literally like, we need you here next week. We'll fly you out, pay for expenses, give us a quote. I was literally just like, give you a quote, like for 1,000 place cards. Like, I don't even know where to begin. Like, I literally was just like, I felt like a fraud. And I also initially was just like, is this a scam? Are they going to kidnap me? And I had 2 of my friends actually come with me to Cannes, because they were like, we'll come as your entourage to make sure, you know, nobody's going to kidnap you. I was in such a state of disbelief. I was like, there's no way this is genuinely happening. And I got back to them and I was like, yes, like I'd love to do it. This is an example of my work. Like, I resent it to them to be like, are you sure you want me to do this? And they were like, yeah, no, your work's great. Like, yeah, we'd love to have you come on over. And I did some, like, you know, some swaps with some colleagues who were really lovely. And thankfully I was able to take sort of annual leave at kind of fairly last minute and flew out there. And it was intense, because even today, if you told me I've got 1,000 place card job, like, that's like 2,000 words to write in like a couple of days. That's a lot of writing. And for somebody who's not, I wasn't an experienced calligrapher at that point. I was kind of, I'd started out and I was, I guess, good, because they'd clearly seen my work and they thought it was good enough. But yeah, I went out there. I was like, this is going to be scary and this is going to be the craziest thing I've done, but like, I'm just going to go out there and give it my best. And I formed some really lovely connections when I was out there. I gave the job like my 100%, maybe a bit more, because I was so grateful that the opportunity came my way. And I think that paved the way for them to want me back for the like subsequent years, because I think that's a big thing I say to people who are starting out, is like, getting a client isn't the end of the road. It's getting that client to come back to you. That's what's important. It's to create that experience for them where they feel, you know what, this fits seamlessly with what we want. And yeah, and I think that's how it happened. Since then, I think a lot of brands have found me again. I think Instagram's a really powerful marketing tool if you use it right. and, you know, putting your work out there, being able to do it in a way where brands can see themselves working with you almost makes a really big difference. Something I'm really mindful of is I only work with brands who I personally use or like. And I think the reason I do that is because I am their target audience. So in doing that, it means that my aesthetic and their aesthetic just naturally match.
Mm.
And I can connect with their audience quite easily because, you know, they're all probably like-minded people like me, and also connect with people that work for, I mean, so if someone's working for a brand, they generally tend to sort of embody that brand's values or ethos. And I think, so again, it's just a seamless process in terms of working with the team within the brand as well. And I think, yeah, that's how it's kind of just snowballed into where it is today.
That is awesome. You mentioned using Instagram correctly. How does one use Instagram correctly? So overwhelming. I don't know how to use mine correctly.
So I don't think there's like the right or wrong way to use it. But what I mean is that to not be put off by the algorithm.
Mm.
Even today, I'll put out content and some of it will absolutely tank and some of it will do really well. But I think what's really important is not let that dissuade you from continuing to do that. When I was found for Cannes via Instagram, I had like 100 followers. I think I had like practically no reach.
Yeah.
And yet somehow someone that was looking for calligraphy stumbled upon my post. Was that the intention with which I put it out there? No. But it taught me that I needed to not look at it and think, you know, like I said, oh, it's only got 4 likes. It's got 4 likes, but actually someone from the Cannes Film Festival saw it and liked it. That means more, you know, in terms of, so I think it's a really powerful tool. And I think making your Instagram space resonate with your own brand values and ethos, I think is a really important thing to do. I try and do that in terms of both aesthetic, but also in terms of the content I put out there, the actual, you know, the wording and the message behind the content I put out there as well. And I think in doing so, I make my space within, you know, Instagram kind of my own. Mm. And I think that's what I probably mean by, so if somebody stumbles upon your page, they can, by looking at it for a couple of seconds, can already understand what you are about as a brand.
Mm.
And I think that in itself is quite a powerful marketing tool.
Mm. Since the time that you had 100 followers and got found by Cannes, you have more followers now. And times have evolved. Do followers matter?
No. I've always said followers don't matter. Followers are a bonus. I think having an engaged community matters. So even within those followers, I have some really meaningful connections with some of my followers. Like, you know, some of them have shared their fertility battles with me. They've shared their griefs with me. They've shared their, like, in their wins with me. And I think that's more important than having like a number of followers. And I always say this, you can't go into a bank and cash your number of followers. Like, it's meaningless in the grand scheme of things if it's not going to be an engaged community that's actually engaging with your brand. Mm. And especially considering I was found at Cannes at like 100 or 200 followers, I think that in itself is telling that the number of followers doesn't matter. It's the quality of your work. As long as you're happy with the work you're putting out there, you feel it represents you both as an artist and a brand. I think that matters more.
Mm.
And people will come. Like, followers, literally, sometimes the difference between one artist and another is a post that went viral.
Yes.
You know? Mm. And if today I'm at the same number of followers as another artist of any variety or another Instagram account, and, you know, my post went viral, does that mean tomorrow I'm suddenly a better artist than the person I was on same, like, at the same peg with yesterday? No. It is just a combination of luck and, I guess, a bit of hard work. But I think if you pin your success or even your happiness based on the number of followers, there is no, like, the number is like kind of infinity, right? Like, how many Instagram accounts exist, including all the bots and whatnot? So, you know, where are you going to draw the line? So I think that's really important I understand it's easy for me to say that here. I do have days where I think about it and I think, oh, you know, that's not gotten many views, or this has not gotten as many likes, or so-and-so has got more followers than me. But I try to check that voice in my head quite quickly. I think it's important to let that voice talk.
Yes.
Because I think in doing that, you're kind of comparing yourself with somebody else. But if you don't have somebody to compare yourself with, you don't know what else you can achieve, right? So if you're comparing yourself with somebody else, that's not a bad thing. That's fine. But as long as you can then use that as motivation to plan your next goal.
Yeah.
And I try and do that every time I feel that way. Every time I feel like, oh, actually, I wish X, Y, and Z was different with my brand, I will sit down and I'll redo my vision board. I'll redo my goals for the year or something. I'll be like, actually, I want to do this. And I think that gives me something else to focus on than those numbers.
A few things spring to mind. I think the first is that the human brain is very numbers oriented. Platforms like Instagram, TikTok they employ, you know, people who understand the brain, and they employ people who will help design those algorithms in a way that make us stay hooked and wanting more. And I think what you said was actually really true, and I think quite important to also highlight, which was it's okay to feel a certain type of way about it for a little while, as long as you're letting yourself sort of come back to center at some point. And I've bashed myself for looking at other accounts or people who do similar things to me and feeling jealous and feeling like, oh, you know. And then you kind of also sometimes go into this like hyper aware mode of like, oh, but that's not even that good, and you know, like, I'm doing well, but blah blah blah. And I think sometimes the worst side of humanity does come out in these things.
Yep.
But equally, I think over time, this was years ago, by the way, when I actually started like quite, you know, new. Now it's reached a point where, and I think we've all started to understand how this whole social media thing works a little bit, how to set our little boundaries. And that time that it takes me from feeling negatively about something to feeling fine about it is a lot shorter now, which is awesome, because I think if it weren't for that, I wouldn't even be here doing this. Because I'd be too in my feels. I'd be too caught up looking at what other people are doing. When it comes to personal relationships, I don't know, we went to the same uni. We might have similar types of friends, but I have a lot of friends who aren't on social media. And I have a number of creative outlets, and some of them I have been made fun of for a lot among my friends, not in a malicious way, but just in a very, let's just bring you back down to earth kind of way. Like, this stuff is fine. But people also just like to remind you that you're doing something differently, right? And I think for a while it got to me. My relationships were maybe put under a little bit of strain because I was putting myself out there. And I got caught up in my head a lot about it. Again, this was a few years ago, but I want to ask you whether you experienced anything like that when you started putting your calligraphy work out there and your page started growing.
To be honest, there were probably undercurrents of that. I think you're right. Like, anyone that starts anything new, especially when it's in its initial stages, or if it's not doing as well, or somebody that just doesn't get it, it's inevitable for them to be like, okay, that's a bit cringe, or like, that's a bit, you know, what are you doing kind of thing. I think it was the reason I actively didn't share anything about my calligraphy page for a very long time. I think the first time I shared it on my personal page was when Oliver Bonus themselves tagged me.
Okay.
Because that felt like a stamp of validation. Not that I needed it, but I felt like, okay, now I can go and share it on my personal page because look, like, a brand's working with me. But, you know, even now saying that sounds really childish because I'm a different person even now than I was back then. And I think keeping that, like, almost protecting it like it was something so valuable to me, and keeping it sort of, I didn't share it anywhere. People found me, like, obviously it would come up on somebody else's page and they would then choose to follow me. And I used that as a way to say, actually, if you're choosing to follow me, then I'm assuming you support what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I've always kept it that way. I think even now I don't really share my Paint Pots and Quills page that much on my personal page because I just think I like to have it as my own space. I like to have people there that understand what I do, that like potentially are inspired what I do, but potentially are like feel like they found a piece of themselves within it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important for me. I think protecting my space is really important. So I don't care if somebody thinks it's lame or somebody thinks it's ridiculous, because, and I strongly feel that success is like the best way to shut those voices down. You know, if somebody says, oh, that's a bit of a lame thing to do, or can't believe, like, you know, there's even a market for it, whatever. Talk even higher, like, you know, shine even brighter, because there's nothing you can do in life where you will have everybody's approval.
Yeah.
And I think I learned very early on that as long as I continue seeking that, I would never have the courage to pursue other things.
It's true.
And if I'm always looking for other people's approval, then I'm not really growing.
Mm.
You know, sometimes you've got to do something for you and not care. Like, you know, it's like what they say about, you know, kids, you know, when they're dancing or they're like painting or whatever they're doing, they don't care what you're thinking in your mind. They're doing it 100% for themselves because they find joy in doing that. And I think as adults, we take ourselves too seriously. And I think we take other people's opinions of us too seriously.
Yeah.
And the way I see it is, if I haven't invited somebody's opinion, I don't care about it.
Mm.
So if I've not openly gone to somebody and asked for their opinion, if they're just giving me their opinion, I'm kind of like, I respect it, but I didn't ask for it. So I'm not going to let it get me down. And I also don't take criticism from people I wouldn't go to for advice.
Mm. That's amen. You are a South Indian in the space of calligraphy. Do you ever think about that? What's representation like in this space? Is there enough of it among South Asians and South Indians specifically?
I think, you know what? That's the one thing within the art space I don't think I've ever thought about.
Mm.
Because I think as an artist, people look at your art.
Mm.
And that's almost like a sort of barrier in between that and your skin color. And I do think there's a lovely representation of, I think this the community and this particular venture, I guess, like, you know, calligraphy, art, whatever, it is open to anybody.
Mm.
There is no hierarchy you have to climb. So I've never personally experienced any sort of discrimination in the space at all. And I think there is a really good representation of people. I know calligraphers of, like, I've come from a variety of, like, all, you know, all walks of life,
mm.
all skin tones, all colors, like, just from different parts of the world, and they're all flourishing in their own way. And I think that is what's really beautiful about this community. And I think it's also really wonderful as an artist, because I don't think anybody looks at anything beyond your art sometimes as an artist. And I think that's a really, like, safe space to be. So I know, I don't think I've ever even thought about it until you asked that question, which I think is a promising, yeah, promising thing, because I don't think I've ever considered that it's a deal, I guess.
Have you ever used your art to hide any form of insecurity or lack of self-worth?
I think I use my art sometimes as a reminder for myself.
Mm.
So I post a lot of quotes, words in other beautiful languages, and a lot of the times when I'm posting something out there, it's usually a message for myself.
Mm.
It's usually like an affirmation or a reminder for myself to say, no, snap out of that insecurity. And I put it out there because, again, I believe if you're going to be doing this, you need to be vulnerable in that. You need to be able to share something openly so that somebody else can also feel seen. So yeah, I think I channel sort of any negative emotion into my art sometimes to try and make it into something more positive.
I love that. And I love that you have that for yourself. And I really feel like everyone deserves to have an outlet. I think when you've got an outlet, and the way that you described it as it's something you need,
mm.
not just something you dabble in anymore, I sometimes feel sad when I see people who don't have that necessarily. And you can almost see, you know, that you were there before you had your art. I feel a similar way. I have that in dance. And despite like the many creative outlets that I've have dabbled in, I think it's always dance that I come back to as something that, slightly differently to you, I've not wanted to pursue in a commercial or career type of way.
Yeah.
And I've come to that conclusion more recently, but I need it. If I don't do it for like a week or 2 weeks, I feel it. It's in my mood. It's in my body. My cells are like tightening up. Mm. My brain's all fuzzy. And then I'm like, it's because I haven't danced. I've not done a class. And it's not even the class. It's sometimes it's just movement. I just put on music and I dance in front of the camera, or not in front of the camera, in front of the mirror rather. Mm. And then suddenly it's like everything's fine again. So it was really interesting hearing you speak about it the way that I, you know, see dance in my life. And it is the creative things, isn't it? Interestingly, because we're told not to pursue, or I think stereotypically told not to pursue entire careers in art. Have you ever considered going full-time as a calligrapher?
I mean, the thoughts crossed my mind, but it's very quickly shut down, because I think the reason this works in the way that it does is because both of these things in my life offset each other.
Mm.
So I have my day job, which I love, and I don't think anything gives me greater happiness than what I do every single day as a doctor. And I don't think I could ever step away from that, because I would feel like I'm, you know, I've spent all these years training. I've got these skills to be able to help someone. So I would always almost feel guilty if I stepped away from that to say, well, I'm no longer using these skills that I have to help somebody. I'm taking one person away from this, you know, space that clearly needs more people to be in that area. So I don't think I could ever fully ever go full time with my calligraphy. But I also think one of the reasons it works, because I never intended for the calligraphy to be commercial.
Mm.
My intention was kind of just to have an experience that is so different to my day job.
Yeah.
I wanted something that was my baby, that was like completely my own, where I didn't need to answer to anybody else. I didn't need to like dictate the direction it was going in. And I think if I went full time with it, I would feel failure if something wasn't going the way I wanted to. Like, I would feel negative emotions towards it. Whereas right now, the way I see it is anything good that happens is a bonus.
Yeah.
Because I'm doing this and I'm creating this work. Like, you know, a lot of the content that I film or the videos that I do, I'm doing that anyway. Like, I'm writing that word in that moment at home anyway. And then it's just a bonus that I posted out, or somebody likes it, or, it, you know, it's everything else that happens is sort of a bonus, is the way I see it. So I think they work really well to complement each other, but I don't think one could work without the other. Now that I know what that's like, I think it would be really hard if I had to give up one or the other to pursue the other one.
What's the most memorable word or name that you've written?
Most memorable. I don't know about the most memorable, but the one that's like my favorite to write is Sarah. I love writing the name Sarah. I think it's a beautiful name, and I really like the way it looks when I write it. And there's so many variations in the way I can write it. And that's been the case ever since, like even when I first wrote calligraphy, like that was one of the names I was drawn towards. And even now, like when I do samples and stuff, like Sarah is like my go-to name, but it's probably that.
That says so much about you, Sneha, because you have written Leo DiCaprio, you have written Naomi Campbell, and she goes for Sarah.
I actually didn't think about any of those names. I genuinely thought that is the prettiest name that I always love writing. It's my default. But yeah, probably now that in hindsight you mentioned those other names, there are obviously other names that I've always been grateful to be able to write.
Mm.
Because I'm like, this person's going to be like so close to this place card. But yeah, no, it's probably still Sarah.
It shows your humility. For anyone struggling to find what they enjoy doing, what words would you share with them based on the experiences you've had so far?
I'd say try anything that you have an inkling for.
Like, if you have a slight curiosity that you want to try something, try it. Like, as long as it's not going to, like, cost you thousands of pounds, like, you know, as long as you're not going to, like, invest. I mean, and even if it does, like, if you think you're going to get some sort of experience out of it, this life is just about experiences. Like, you know, at the end of the day, we will all be stories.
Mm.
And it will be the moments we collected that would mean something to us. That is really the currency of this lifetime. So I would just say anything that you're even slightly inclined to try, just go for it. You may just find that it's changed. It changes the way you cope. You may find a little bit of happiness from it. You may find anything from that. You just don't know if you don't try. And I think that's probably the simplest way I could put it.
You're right. We are a sum total of the little experiences that we go through in life, aren't we? Final question for you, Sneha. What do you have strong game in?
I have a strong game in making a cup of tea. A really good masala chai is probably where my strong game lies. I think there's very little in life that a cup of tea doesn't solve. And yeah, I think that would be what I have a strong game in.
Would you share your recipe?
So my mum uses, so the standard stuff, obviously, a crushed cardamom, a couple of crushed cardamoms, some ginger, let that all seep together boil it in a pan. It has to be in a pan with, some tea bags. Any tea bag will do. I'm not fussy about that part of it. But, the secret of something a friend of mine does, is she uses crushed fennel seeds.
Okay.
Which adds a really different, like, if you don't like your tea sweet, like if you don't take sugar in your tea, that just adds that like hint of sweetness. Cause I think masala tea can't be done without sugar, but obviously some people don't have sugar, which is fine.
Mm.
But the fennel seeds elevate the whole experience. That's probably my secret.
Love it.
Now that I've told you, I'll have to kill you.
I hope not. Thank you so much, Sneha, for sharing today with us, for sharing space, for sharing your stories. Your little tips and tricks. I got so much out of this conversation today. I'm secretly, my little fangirl is screaming because I have fangirled over you for years now. I'm just really, really grateful that we have had this conversation today. And I just want to thank you for your time.
No, thank you for having me here. I think just talking through all of this is almost feels like therapy. You know, like it's just, these are parts of me that I've kind of done without giving it any thought.
Yeah.
And so to put it all into words, to actually delve deeper to understand why I've done all of this, it's been really eye-opening for me as well. So it's been a really, really lovely experience for me being here as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I can't wait to see all the awesome calligraphy that you're going to create and continue to do so. And I know I'd said that I've asked the final question, but do you have any dream clients or work that you want to put out that you're willing to manifest today?
My dream client.
Or just anything that you're looking to do next with Paint Pots and Quills.
I think I would just really love to work on another event that has some sort of charitable motive. I think that's like my next big dream. Like I would love to work on a big charitable event that is making a difference and to bring my calligraphy to that. That would be what I would hope to manifest from this little couch. I hope that we're able to do that. But yeah, that would be my dream.
We all heard it first here. And yeah, wishing you all the best with it. It's just amazing to see it unfold.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.